This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. We're coming to you live from London. I'm James Menendez. And we're going to begin today in the United States and what might be described as an avalanche of presidential pardons in the past few days from the outgoing President Joe Biden and, of course, the new occupant of the White House, Donald Trump. Mr. Trump had barely got his feet under the Oval Office desk before issuing a near blanket pardon for more than 1,500 of his supporters who stormed Congress on January the 6th, 4 years ago. He described their sentences as ridiculous and excessive. At a news conference in Washington, he was asked whether rioters who attacked police officers should be held to account. He replied saying they should, but added that their sentences could be shortened.
They've served years in jail. And murderers don't even go to jail in this country. And we had 1,500. We have 16 under review. As you know, we commuted about 16 of them because it looks like they could have done things that were not acceptable for a full pardon. No, we pardoned people that were treated unbelievably well, poorly. In the history of our country, there's never been anything take place like this.
There's one conviction which has been overturned, which is raising a lot of eyebrows, and it's the unconditional pardon given to Ross Ulbricht, the founder of the dark web marketplace Silk Road. Ulbricht was sentenced to life in prison back in 2015 for running the site where criminals could trade drugs using Bitcoin. Let's talk to the BBC cyber correspondent Joe Tidy, who's with me in the studio. Perhaps just remind us what the dark web is and what exactly happened on Silk Road.
Yes, so Silk Road was the first of these dark web marketplaces. The dark web is a part of the internet that's only accessible through specific software. You need to download something called the Tor browser, which stands for the Onion router. And then it works like a similar to like a Google or a Chrome or whatever. Once you know the address you want to go to, you can type it in, it will take you there. But it's not indexed like the normal websites and like the normal internet. So it's much harder to use. And it's also, crucially, very privacy conscious because your internet traffic is bounced around the world, so people can't really tell where you're from, and they can't tell where the websites are hosted either. So you can start what is now a big industry of dark net marketplaces selling all sorts of illegal things, and the police can't really find you. And that's what Ross Ulbricht did. He started up the first ever one called Silk Road, which sold any manner of illegal items you can imagine, all sorts of drugs, malware, hacking services, even hitmen as well.
And as I mentioned, he was sentenced to life in prison and life without parole, I think. Why, then, has Donald Trump pardoned him? I mean, do we know what the rationale behind it is?
Well, first of all, the rationale behind the sentencing was this was the first darknet marketplace. There had to be a big message sent to other people that might do copycat websites. They want to send a message, make a kind of an example of Ross Ulbricht, and that's why he had such a high sentence, which is also, I have to be said, it's always been questioned a little bit.
Yeah, some people were surprised, weren't they?
That was a high sentence, a very, very strong sentence sent to him. But the cause behind his release and behind Ross Ulbricht's innocence, if you like, was from the libertarians in America. A very, very loud, very prominent group. We know that Donald Trump went to them as part of his campaign. Ross Ulbricht was brought up as a potential campaign issue, and he said back then, "Well, this sounds too much. I'm gonna pardon him." And that's it seems to be where this idea of the pardoning came from. And I think no one's surprised by the pardoning. Trump said he would do it, but what has really got people shocked today is the manner in which he did it. It was a full unconditional pardon, but if you look at the post that accompanied it on Truth Social, Trump's social network, he said, "The scum that worked to convict him were some of the same lunatics who were involved in the modern day weaponization of government against me." And I think a lot of people in the law enforcement world would say that characterization of these police officers and prosecutors as scum is potentially quite offensive to them, because, of course, this was the Silk Road website was responsible for some really heinous crimes. About $131 million worth of drugs sold through there. People lost their lives taking some of the drugs, which were perhaps laced with some chemicals that they shouldn't have been. Ross Ulbricht has also been linked to six different attempts to get people killed. None of those were ever proven or actually happened, but he paid for people to be killed. So I think the shock today has come from the manner in which the pardon has happened.
Joe, thank you very much indeed. Our cyber correspondent, Joe Tidy. Well, does this pardon take us into uncharted territory for this practice? John Jones is a former federal judge and now president of Dickinson College in Pennsylvania.
I think that it does because of the nature of the crimes. They're grave and in some cases pretty heinous. So, yes, I think we are unfortunately blazing new and uncharted territory.
Some people were surprised at the length of the sentence that he was given, life without parole. Could that be something that an incoming president would consider? But I guess pardons and commutations are completely different things, aren't they?
That's exactly the point. And in fact, when Mr. Ulbricht appealed his sentence, the court commented that they may not have sentenced him to that length, but it was fully within the purview of the district judge to do so. I think reasonable people could differ about the length of the sentence. And in that case, the president, of course, has the commutation power, as you note, and that commutation can shorten the sentence without excusing the crime. But a sweeping pardon, which is what President Trump did, in effect, washes away and excuses the crime. And I think that's very difficult for people to absorb, given the nature of the offenses that he committed.
And that could also have applied to the January the 6th rioters. President Trump could have commuted their sentences, but allowed the convictions to stand. But he chose not to. But one can see in that case, there was more of a political imperative, perhaps.
That's precisely correct as well. And you can see that a number of Republican elected officials, senators, Congress people are caught flat-footed, though, by the sweeping pardons of the January 6th protesters. You have people who injured police officers, who defaced the seat of government of the United States, who invaded the Capitol building. You're washing away the crimes. Commutation would be a statement that goes to the sentences, but not necessarily the crimes. But this is a typical Trumpian move in the sense that he just makes that big, broad gesture. But I think it's not sitting well with folks in both parties.
Yeah. And on that, I mean, Joe Biden, he said, I believe raw politics has infected this process, referring to the process of pardoning. And yet, I mean, he has faced just as much criticism for the pardons that he issued, including in the sort of final minutes of his presidency, and of course, pardoning his own son, Hunter Biden, when he said he wouldn't.
You know, the pardoning process is broken in the United States. It's being abused. There's no question about it. And to your point, you know, at about 11:37, literally at the 11th hour on Inauguration Day on Monday, you're right, then President Biden pardoned all of his family members. Although I could argue intellectually that Trump's gestures are far more sweeping and maybe more troubling than Biden's, for the average person, they look at this and they think it's everybody's doing it. You know, they don't see any degree of difference between President Biden pardoning his son, his family members, folks on death row, or President Trump making the pardons that he did over the last couple days. I think we need to get a handle on this process because it's become almost an industry at this point, and not a particularly good one, you know, not a good front-facing look for the United States.
Just one final thought. I mean, you're a former federal judge. What does all this do to the rule of law and indeed attitudes towards the rule of law?
How do you deter conduct when, you know, you truncate people's sentences and forgive these, I think, pretty heinous crimes? So deterrence goes out the window. Respect for the law, well, you know, if you think with impunity you can, for example, operate the dark web and sell hundreds of millions of dollars of drugs in the case of Mr. Ulbricht, or invade the Capitol and destroy property, well, that hardly fosters respect for the law. So I think it turns the rule of law on its head. And as a former judge, I'm really pretty deeply troubled about the direction that we're heading with this.
Former federal judge John Jones. Now, Prince Harry has reached an out-of-court settlement today in his long-running legal battle over phone hacking with Rupert Murdoch's media company News Group Newspapers. The firm, which publishes the tabloid The Sun, has offered what have been described as substantial damages and a, quote, full and unequivocal apology to the prince for serious intrusions into his private life. It also apologised for intruding into the private life of his late mother, Princess Diana. While speaking outside the court in London, his lawyer David Sherborne warned that those involved in illegal phone hacking remained in prominent positions.
Far from being relics of a distant past, many of those behind these unlawful practices remain firmly entrenched in senior positions today, both within News UK and other media outlets across the world, wielding editorial power and perpetuating the toxic culture in which they continue to thrive.
Let's talk to the BBC's Helena Wilkinson, who's also outside the court. And Helena, just first of all, remind us what exactly News Group was accused of doing.
Well, they were accused by Prince Harry and also another claimant, the former Labour MP Tom Watson, for unlawful news gathering, getting information unlawfully about private lives, ending up in newspapers. Today, there was, as we've heard, a settlement after years of getting this case to trial. And for Prince Harry, he has always wanted to get the case to trial because he has spoken many times about wanting accountability. It's not, in his view, he said, about the money in terms of damages. He wanted for everything to be laid bare in court. Well, today, News Group Newspapers have settled with both of them. They have apologised to Prince Harry, to both of them. But Prince Harry, the apology is for serious intrusion into his private life, but also goes further, and they apologise for serious intrusion into the private life of Harry's late mother, Princess Diana. So this will feel like a very personal statement to Prince Harry because of that. But it's been a very bitter battle to reach this point. It was completely unexpected, this settlement agreed in the very last moments. The trial was actually meant to start yesterday, but there were delays. And this morning, that final settlement, and it is a really important settlement. It's a huge settlement, and it's the first time NGN publishers of The Sun have admitted wrongdoing against Prince Harry. And as I say, he will feel vindicated.
Yeah, Helena, we've only got about sort of 40 seconds left. I mean, given that he always said he wouldn't settle, do we know why he did?
Well, I think it will be exactly that, about the apology, the full and unequivocal apology that they have received and he has received from News Group Newspapers. And we heard there David Sherborne, his barrister outside, talking about the fact that also that this represents a vindication for hundreds of other claimants, he said, who were strong-armed into settling. So I think without that apology that he has received today, I don't think he would have settled.
Thank you very much, Helena. That was the BBC's Helena Wilkinson joining us from outside the High Court in London. You're listening to News Hour. Coming up later on the programme, the struggle to keep Ukraine's war zone hospitals free of infection.
Дуже великий потік.
When there is a massive influx, we will have a contamination with pathogens. When we have a contamination, it means we get hospital-acquired infections.
More on that coming up in about 20 minutes. Let's just recap our main headlines this hour. Rupert Murdoch's News Group Newspapers, which owns one of Britain's biggest tabloids, has apologised to Prince Harry and agreed to pay substantial damages for intruding into his private life. And Palestinian officials say at least 10 people have been killed and nearly 40 injured as Israel continues a major military operation in Jenin in the occupied West Bank. We'll be getting more details on that in about 25 minutes. This is James Menendez with NewsHour live from the BBC. Let's turn to Iraq now, where MPs have passed a controversial amendment to the country's personal status law, as it's known, that could reduce the legal marriage age for girls from 18 to just 9 years old. The changes would give religious courts more power over family issues such as marriage, divorce and child custody, allowing some hardline Shia clerics to rule according to their interpretations of Islamic law. Well, Shahrukh Abayachi is a former Iraqi MP and head of the National Civil Movement Opposition Group. First of all, her reaction to the amendments being passed.
I'm very upset, and we've been against this amendment over years now, over decades. I mean, with 9 or 15 or even 16, it's still not suitable age to allow marriage for girls.
And if it's not a naive question, I mean, who are the people in Iraq who want to marry girls as young as 9?
Actually, it's a range of factors that encourage people to think about getting their girls get married at that age because of economic situation, because of believing in such religious beliefs that they might have regarding the beliefs that the girls should be at home and should get married and have children and nothing else. The backward political forces, mainly Islamic ones, they encourage such thoughts in the society instead of encouraging what we have used to have in Iraqi society, that girls should be get educated, should finish their studies, should be economically independent. The ruling power, they do the opposite.
And was it Islamist politicians that pushed these changes through? And I know that many people, and I'm sure you're one of them, were very angry about the way it was done.
Yes. Yesterday, it was kind of catastrophic in the parliamentarian legislations. I mean, the way they did it, it's not even a legislative one. It was just chaos, and they forced the amendment and the exceptions of the law just in a way that we haven't seen before.
And just to be clear, I mean, what the change in the law does is allow Islamic courts more authority over these kinds of issues. Is that right?
Actually, it is the law they established yesterday. It's only for Shia under the name of Al-Ja'fari law, which is the first time in whole Iraqi legislative system it's mentioned Shia on Sunni on such things. We haven't seen this before, and that's a very dangerous perspective, actually. I mean, the valid law since 1959, it gives the freedom for people to choose which direction or which religious perspective they can arrange their civil status without sectarian backgrounds.
And what's the significance of that, do you think? Does that just further exacerbate divisions that exist in Iraq, do you think?
Yeah, of course. It's more sectarian attempts to divide the Iraqi society, more fragmentation of the society that used to be, I mean, we have a diversity of religions, of sectarian backgrounds, but without focusing on that, even in the law. Now, the political parties or political powers, they want to use it to make the Iraqi society more fragile and against each other.
Of course, it is pretty horrifying to think of, you know, girls as young as 9 getting married. Is there anything you can do to stop that happening? I mean, is there any way you could begin to try to repeal these changes?
First steps, it will be appealing the law at the Supreme Court. Still we have for tomorrow a protest, and we plan for more activities to raise the voice against the way they legislated and the way they are trying to amend the law.
And that was the former Iraqi MP Shahrukh Abayachi there. Now, are top flight footballers really as dumb as they sometimes seem? Or is it just a tired old stereotype? Well, there are quite a few examples to back up the theory. Take David Beckham saying he wanted his son Brooklyn to be christened but didn't know into which religion. Or the ex-Manchester City player Mario Balotelli, who set his house on fire after hosting a fireworks display in his bathroom. Then there's England's Jack Grealish. He was shown a map of the UK and asked to put a sticker marking where he lived.
I don't have a Scooby, honestly.
Let's see. Does Jack Grealish know where he's from?
No, he doesn't.
No.
That's where you are. Problem is, that's like 80 miles out because it's a big old map. So you need to dust up on your geography.
However, a new academic study has found that in reality, professional footballers, and I imagine this could apply to lots of other sports, are very intelligent. Leonardo Bonetti, research fellow in psychiatry at the University of Oxford and the lead author of this new study, told me what they found.
Well, essentially, we found that the cognitive abilities of the players were extremely higher compared to the control participants. And this was true across all of the different tests that we used. So, for instance, football players had much higher executive functions, but also much higher working memory and ability of solving logical problems and planning in general. At the same time, we also found a very specific set of personality traits in elite football players, like they had much higher levels of extraversion, conscientiousness, and openness to experience. But at the same time, they were also less agreeable compared to control participants and also less prone to neuroticism, so more able to handle pressure compared to, regular people.
And less agreeable? In what way? Do you mean they're just harder to get on with?
Well, this is a trait that comes out from this psychological test. But essentially, yes. So I wouldn't say that they are not honest or not good people. This is definitely not what I'm saying. But they are definitely not the kindest people in the world. And I think this speaks a lot about if you want to succeed, you probably need to be slightly selfish, not necessarily very, very kind, I would say, if you want to win.
Yeah, you need to be very, very focused on what you want to achieve, for sure. So do you think all these traits that you found, these levels of intelligence, are kind of critical to their success on the field, these things like problem solving and so on?
Yes, it really seems that these different traits and cognitive abilities are really important for succeeding in the field. And that was also supported by our analysis with artificial intelligence, which showed that we can essentially predict whether a football player is a football player or a control with 97% of accuracy, suggesting that essentially nearly all of the football players had this set of cognitive skills. And this is very likely that if you don't have this set of cognitive skills, you wouldn't succeed.
So that's interesting. So once you'd run the tests, did you feed that back into a system so you could basically create a profile of what makes a top footballer?
Exactly. We could train the algorithm to essentially establish what is the model of the ideal psychological profile of the football players. And then we could use this model to essentially evaluate other data and see, just based on these cognitive tests and personality tests, we could guess with 97% of accuracy whether the next person was a football player or a control.
You didn't test for verbal skills, though, do you? And that does seem to be where some footballers at least trip up quite regularly.
It's true. We didn't test verbal intelligence because we were mostly focused on this performance matrix that in our hypothesis were the ones that were mostly related to football. So we can't say what happens with the verbal intelligence, but it might be true that perhaps verbal intelligence wouldn't be higher for football players. And that might explain also why there is this general idea that football players are not necessarily the smartest people in the world, even if our results seem to suggest the other way around.
Leonardo Bonetti of the University of Oxford there. You're listening to NewsHour. Do stay with us. Lots more coming up. Welcome back to NewsHour. Now, four lynx were captured in the Scottish Highlands earlier this month after they were released into the wild illegally. Conservationists have condemned what's sometimes called guerrilla rewilding, that's guerrilla with a G-U-E, as reckless and irresponsible. But there are a number of people in the UK who believe that rare and even extinct species should be reintroduced regardless of what the rules say. Our climate and environment editor Justin Rowlatt has been to meet one of them.
Derek Gow has three lynx on his farm in Devon, a male and two females. They're beautiful golden-eyed creatures, about the size of a Labrador, but much sleeker and more muscular.
That is a dramatic cat, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
These cats are in a secure caged compound, but until a few hundred years ago, lynx roamed wild in the UK, and Gow believes they should do again.
You've got lynx. Did you release lynx into Scotland?
I did not release lynx in Scotland.
Would you consider doing that?
Would I consider doing it? I think it'd be really difficult. And our cats would not be good candidate cats because they're so tame. The creatures that should be here aren't here because of what we did in the past. And now that we just don't need as many sheep or all the food in theory that, you know, where the landscape's going to produce, why can't we start to restore some of the lost creatures to it?
This is not just a hobby. Derek Gow's 400-acre farm here in Devon has become a centre for breeding rare species. He employs 15 people, and while he may not have any plans to release his lynx into the wild anytime soon, this place has become a hub for other covert species reintroductions.
The girl.
In a shed on the farm, some of his team are checking on the health of the hundreds of water voles they're breeding.
They've got very pretty teeth.
They pick up the rodents. Ratty from Wind in the Willows was a water vole, by their tails and pop them in cardboard snack tubes to be weighed.
110. So you've got some growing to do, my love.
Gow says he's released some 25,000 of this once common, now endangered species. His menagerie also includes polecats, Scottish wildcats and adders. Gow makes no bones about his plans to release some of these into the wild. Tom Bradshaw is president of the National Union of Farmers.
This is irresponsible. You don't know the damage that could be done. You don't know the financial impacts that could be caused. Where are the impact assessments? And in the event that we end up in a position where they need to be controlled, there is no ability to control those species. So I think it really is irresponsible.
Derek Gow is unrepentant.
Well, I'm making unilateral decisions, but those decisions are to release, I don't know, a lot of benign water vole. You know, I'm doing good things. I'm on the side of the small and oppressed. I don't think I'm doing anything bad.
Some see him as a courageous visionary. Others regard him as an arrogant maverick whose animal releases could do more harm than good.
That was our climate and environment editor, Justin Rowlatt, reporting from Devon in England. You're listening to NewsHour live from the BBC in London. I'm James Menendez. Let's turn to the war in Ukraine now. In a moment, we'll hear about the toll the conflict's taking on the country's hospitals, in particular the infection rates afflicting injured soldiers. But first to the fate of the thousands of North Korean troops sent to fight alongside Russia in Ukraine. Let's talk to our security correspondent, Frank Gardner, who's with me in the studio. Very good to have you with us. What has happened to them?
Well, they've suffered massive casualties, according to Western officials who spoke to me both exclusively but also on grounds of anonymity. I mean, they are, I can assure you, legit officials, but of course I've got no means of, you know, I have not wandered around the battlefield counting the corpses myself, I'm afraid, but there's no reason to doubt this. They're saying that of the roughly 11,000 contingent that was sent from North Korea, from what's called the DPRK, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, to Russia to help President Putin evict the Ukrainian forces from the Kursk salient. If you remember, in August last year, Ukraine did that lightning raid, that incursion into Kursk, and they've stayed there ever since. The territory they've seized has shrunk, but they're still there, and President Putin is determined to get them out ahead of any peace negotiations. Well, he's been using the North Koreans to help him do that. And these Western officials say that they have suffered 4,000 casualties out of the 11,000. That's nearly 40%. Casualties means what? Means killed, wounded, missing, or captured. And of the 4,000, they're saying 1,000 have been killed. That's a very high number. That's an unsustainable attrition rate. And we all know that the attrition rate in the Donbass, where Ukraine is slowly pulling back, very slowly, as sheer weight of Russian forces moves forward. But there are enormous losses on both sides. The biggest losses numerically are on the Russian side. And I spoke just a few minutes ago, actually, to the former British Army tank commander, Colonel Hamish de Breton Gordon, who said they are being used as cannon fodder. They're being thrown into the meat grinder. They won't understand the orders given by their Russian officers in charge of them. And those Russian officers will care for their lives even less than they care for the lives of their own men, the Russians.
And are they also badly trained?
Well, it depends what metric you're using. So in North Korean terms, they are supposed to be elite troops. They're from something called the Storm Corps. So they are better fed, slightly bulkier, bigger, men than the ordinary conscript. They've got bigger rations of rice, better conditions when they leave. When they finally leave after many years' service, they have better remuneration. But you're throwing them into a 21st century combat zone where the use of FPV, first-person view drones, is daily and a daily nightmare for them. So South Korean intelligence has been commenting on this, saying, we think they are simply just, they're not able to cope with 21st century warfare. I mean, one of the big lessons to come out of the Ukraine war is that drones are an absolutely integral part of the battle space now, right down to section level, down to, you know, formations of just eight men, and it is usually men. And these North Koreans are seen flailing around, don't know what to do with these drones coming towards them with an explosive payload. So Colonel Hamish de Breton Gordon said, I actually feel, as a soldier, an ex-soldier, he said, I feel sorry for them. Nobody should be treated like with cannon fodder like that. This is the 21st century, and yet that's exactly what's happening. So, there are two questions here. Are they going to be replaced? Because that is an unsustainable attrition rate for the North Koreans. They are no longer a contiguous unit in the way that they were when they arrived. And what is North Korea getting in return? Is it just food and money? Because South Korea is worried about this. Those that survive will come back battle-hardened and therefore a bigger threat to South Korea. But is Putin going to give North Korea, is it going to give it, for example, technical assistance on its missile program, on its space program, on its submarine program? There's a lot of question marks there.
Frank, thank you very much indeed. Our security correspondent Frank Gardner there. Well, the war in Ukraine is putting its health system under unprecedented pressure. Hospitals are overcrowded and understaffed, and the conditions are making it extremely hard to contain the spread of infections that are resistant to antibiotics, considered a major global health threat. The resistance means that patients are dying because they don't respond to any known treatments. The BBC's Abdul Jalil Abdurrasulov has visited hospitals in Kyiv and Dnipro to learn how medical facilities are coping with these challenges.
In a spacious hall, two women wearing a wreath of flowers play the Ukrainian national instrument, the bandura. This is an initiation ceremony for young medics who recently joined the Mechnikov Hospital in Dnipro. To get new staff is a big relief for the hospital's administration. This facility, like most others across Ukraine, needs more people to deal with the biggest influx of patients since World War II. Dr. Volodymyr Dubina, the head of the intensive care unit at the Mechnikov Hospital, explains the threats they face.
When there is a massive influx, we will have a contamination with pathogens. When we have a contamination, it means we get hospital-acquired infections.
Dr. Dubina talks about antimicrobial resistance. That's when antibiotics and other medicine don't work. It's a global problem, but the war in Ukraine makes it much more challenging to contain its spread. Since the start of the Russian invasion, the number of beds in just one intensive care unit of the Mechnikov Hospital has tripled, while the number of staff has decreased. So maintaining sterile conditions has become much harder. And since evacuation of wounded soldiers involves several hospitals, dangerous pathogens spread even further. Today, more than 80% of patients admitted to a Feofania hospital in Kyiv have resistance to antibiotics. This is a recording of a surgery doctors did on one such patient, Private Alexander Bezverkhny, who was wounded a year ago. It's too shocking to describe his wounds, but treating his flesh ripped off by shrapnel would have been much easier had he not been infected with bacteria resistant to drugs. Because of this, Private Bezverkhny had sepsis 5 times. It's been so painful. I constantly called doctors at night, he says. Dr. Strokan, deputy chief physician at Feofania Hospital, says Alexander had more chances to die then live.
We've carried out more than 100 surgeries on him. And even at those stages, he got new infections. So what did we do? We did what every clinic should do. We isolated him.
But the Ukrainian hospitals seldom keep their critical patients in separate wards. Too many wounded and too little space. Patients mix and contaminate each other. To treat infections resistant to drugs, doctors prescribe antibiotics from what they call a reserve list. But the more they use them, the quicker the bacteria will adapt to those antibiotics. And when it happens, the reserved medication will become ineffective too. Dr. Strokin again.
We have to balance our scales. On the one hand, we must save the patient. On the other, we mustn't breed new microorganisms that will have resistance.
Private Bezverkhny is now going through rehabilitation. Doctors managed to cure his wounds. But as pathogens grow more resistant, the struggle to save other lives gets only harder.
That was Abdul-Jalil Abdul-Rasulov reporting there from Ukraine. Now, there have been explosions and gunfire in and around the city of Jenin in the occupied West Bank as Israel continues what it's called an extensive counter-terrorism operation there. Local medics are saying that at least 10 people have been killed and dozens of others wounded in airstrikes. Let's talk to the BBC's Jonah Fisher, who's following all this from Jerusalem. What more can you tell us about what's going on in Jenin?
Yeah, so this is the second day of the Israeli military operation in Jenin, which is a stronghold of Palestinian militant groups in the northern part of the West Bank. We've been hearing today that in particular there's been activity around Jenin Hospital with armoured bulldozers being used by the Israeli military to blockade areas around the entrances and exits of that hospital. As you said, there have been reports of airstrikes and of gunfire. The number of people who've died in this incursion has gone up from 8 yesterday to 10 today. There was a briefing this morning that I was on with the Israeli Defense Forces. The spokesman there was very clear to stress that the reason that they were doing this was to try and stop what they called terror attacks across Israel on settlers and elsewhere, that they had traced back the origin of these attacks to militants inside Jenin and nearby areas. He called it a big hub for terror attacks. So this is what the Israelis are saying all across the West Bank at the moment. There are a lot more checkpoints. It is much harder to move around. It's clear that the Israeli security forces are really trying to shut down some of these areas so the militant groups who they are targeting, particularly around Jenin, can't leave.
And Jonah, what about the timing of this? As you mentioned, these groups have been in places like Jenin, well, for decades. Why is Israel taking this action now, do you think?
Well, look, Israel does go into Jenin periodically. The last big incursion in there was in August of last year. But you're right to say it is interesting timing to go in on the Tuesday after the Gaza ceasefire started on the Sunday. A cynic would say that this might be Prime Minister Netanyahu reaching out to appease the far-right members of his own cabinet who were very upset about the Gaza ceasefire. They wanted the war to continue there. So this may be, in a way, something to offer them in terms of tackling what the defence forces here say are those militant groups which have been attacking settler communities.
And add to that, I mean, just thinking about the timing of the presidential inauguration and violence between Palestinians and Israeli settlers in the occupied West Bank, the incoming Trump administration has cancelled some of those sanctions against settlers, hasn't it?
Yeah, in the last few days, there have been more attacks by extremist settler groups on Palestinian villages. Just last night, there was one south of Hebron. Five Palestinians were reported injured in that attack. There was another one on Monday evening. And as you say, yes, one of the very first things that the incoming president, Donald Trump, did was to cancel the sanctions which the Biden administration had put on these so-called extremist settler groups in the West Bank who are trying to expand territory. So one could see that as being giving something of a green light to these groups to continue trying to attack Palestinian communities and drive them off their land.
Jonah, many thanks. That was the BBC's Jonah Fisher joining us live there from Jerusalem. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. This is James Menendez with NewsHour. Among the raft of executive orders that President Trump has already signed are measures to curb illegal migration into the US, including ending the right to citizenship for people born in America. Mr. Trump has also threatened to deport, quote, millions and millions of people already in the US who may have come illegally. That may start happening any day now. Some of the changes are expected to be challenged in the courts, while others are already having an effect, including an end to the system of booking appointments for people to claim asylum while they wait across the border in Mexico. From Tijuana on the US-Mexico border, Will Grant reports.
This shelter, which is just walking distance from the US border, is made up of around 40 cheap nylon tents set up under a corrugated iron roof, but it protects these families from the elements and gives them a place to wash their clothes and get a hot meal as they wait to request asylum in front of the American authorities.
Oralia and her two children, one of whom has epilepsy, have been living in one of those tents for the past 7 months. Unable to secure an appointment for asylum, President Trump's raft of executive actions immediately shut down her best legal option of entering the United States. It's very unjust that they won't let us cross the border to make our cases, she said through the tears. They don't know what's happening to us here in Mexico. In Oralia's case, she's fleeing a death threat in her home state of Michoacán. However, 17-year-old Marcos, not his real name, is fleeing a cartel itself. Forcibly recruited to a cartel a year ago, when he managed to escape, he and his entire family immediately traveled to the border. He's confident that he can show what the U.S. immigration courts call credible fear, but only, he says, if he can get the opportunity to make his case.
I hope they look at the circumstances of every person and take each case on its merit, and that Mr. Trump's heart softens to help those who truly need it, because often they support those who don't need it in life and leave people like us behind.
I will declare a national emergency at our southern border.
Across the border, Donald Trump's supporters in what is a strengthened and invigorated Republican Party in California gathered in San Diego to watch his inaugural speech.
Any other place you go in the world, they control their borders. So we need to be given the opportunity to control our border.
The local party chairwoman, Paula Witzel, says she welcomes the president's plans to launch what he calls the biggest deportation in American history.
Our system here in San Diego County is very burdened by this heavy weight of all these people coming in, and we're just not built for it. The county is not made to be able to sustain this.
I mean, that's presumably Tijuana right there, yeah?
That's correct, yeah. So this area between the border walls is known as...
At one end of the border wall, a humanitarian group called American Friends Service Committee has set up a tent where migrants can find water, a blanket, and maybe some food while they wait for Border Patrol to pick them up. Its director, Pedro Rios, says the Trump administration will depict migrants as criminals for political ends.
It's about creating a bogeyman for people to fear, and that then justifies the passage of policies and measures that completely eviscerate the asylum process and allow for human rights abuses to be committed without accountability or oversight mechanisms.
Meanwhile, migrants continue to arrive at the Chaparral border crossing in Tijuana, mobile phone in hand, requesting interviews via a system that President Trump has already shut down.
That was Will Grant reporting there. Let's turn to Afghanistan now, a country in the grip of a humanitarian crisis, partly because of natural disasters and also because of an economy that's largely collapsed since the Taliban seized back power in 2021 after America's chaotic withdrawal. And a country where women and girls are still denied the right to work and receive an education because of the Taliban's extreme interpretation of Sharia law. Well, this week, one Taliban minister called on the group's senior leadership to reopen schools for Afghan women, a rare internal rebuke. I've been talking to Jan Egeland, who's head of the Norwegian Refugee Council. He's in Afghanistan at the moment. What's he seen?
The assessment we have collectively with the UN is that 22.9 million people need humanitarian assistance. And on top of that, Iran has declared an intention to deport 2 million Afghans. I was at the border with Iran, and I could see the 3,000 that came over that day. They told me, we come with nothing, and we return to nothing. And many donors have cut development assistance, are reducing humanitarian assistance.
And some of those international organizations have pulled out because they don't want to engage with the Taliban government, the Taliban leadership. But you've always thought that that was the wrong idea, that it's better to engage. Why is that? And has it made any difference, do you think?
We have been able to do a lot since then. There is one huge problem we have made no progress on, and that is that the Taliban banned education for girls beyond primary school.
Yes, and as you say, that hasn't got any better. In fact, things have got worse. I mean, are you able, when you meet Taliban officials, are you able to raise that issue with them?
Absolutely. That's 80% of my meeting time goes on those issues. Some say, oh, it's temporary, give us time when conditions are right, education will resume. Then others say, well, it's not a given that we will follow your traditions. Then I say, it's not our traditions, it's basic human rights.
Can I ask you about something else, given that all that you've said about the humanitarian situation and the situation for women and girls as regards education and work, I just wonder if you've seen it, what you think of the reports that about 1,600 Afghan refugees deemed for resettlement in the US, many because of their work with the United States a few years ago, or they may be family members, won't be allowed to go because President Trump has cancelled the US's refugee resettlement programs. What do you make of that?
I think it's an example that Western countries basically leave their promises. They said they would take care of the people they worked with. And these are people vetted for a very long time. And then they are stopped mid-air. Of course, the Trump administration also announced now a 90-day suspension of all new aid contracts. We're trying to find out whether that is development and also humanitarian aid. If it was humanitarian aid, it would be disastrous.
And that was Jan Egeland, who's head of the Norwegian Refugee Council, speaking to me from Kabul in Afghanistan. That's it for this edition of NewsHour. Thanks so much for listening. Till the next time. Bye-bye.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this
the secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.